time over the past few months on a folder named Dag Svensson, apparently a book project. Then she opened Blomqvist's email and read carefully through the address list in his correspondence. One address made Salander jump. On January 26th, Blomqvist had got an email from Harriet fucking Wanger. She opened the message and read a few concise lines about a board meeting to take place at the Millennium offices. The message ended with the information that Wanger had booked the same hotel room as last time. Salander digested the information. Then she shrugged and downloaded Blomqvist's mail, Svensson's book manuscript with the working title The Leeches and the subtitle Society's Support for the Prostitution Industry. She also found a copy of a thesis entitled From Russia with Love, written by a woman named Mia Johansson. She disconnected and went into the kitchen to put on some coffee. Then she sat on her new sofa in the living room with her power book. She opened Mimi's cigarette case and lit a Marlboro light. The rest of the evening she spent reading. By 9, she had finished Johansson's thesis. She bit her lower lip. By 10:30 she had finished Svensson's book. Millennium would soon be making headlines again. At 11:30 she was reading the last of Blomqvist's emails when she suddenly sat up and opened her eyes wide. She felt a cold shiver go down her spine. It was a message from Svensson to Blomqvist. In an aside, Svensson mentioned that he had some tentative ideas about an Eastern European gangster named Zala, who might get a chapter all to himself, but acknowledged that there was not much time till the deadline. Blomqvist hadn't answered the email. Zala. Salander sat motionless until the screensaver went on. Svensson put aside his notebook and scratched his head. He gazed at the single word at the top of the page in his notebook. Four letters. Zala. He spent 3 minutes deep in thought, drawing labyrinthine rings around the name. Then he went and got a cup of coffee from the kitchenette. It was time to go home to bed, but he had discovered that he enjoyed working late at the Millennium offices when it was quiet in the building. He had all the material under control, but for the first time since he started the project he felt uneasy that he might have missed an important detail. Zala. Until that point, he had been impatient to finish the writing and get the book published, but now he wished he had more time. He thought about the autopsy report that Inspector Gulbrandsson had let him read. Irina P.'s body had been found in Södertälje Canal. She had devastating injuries to her face and chest. The cause of death was a broken neck, but two of her other injuries had been judged fatal. 6 ribs had been broken, and her left lung punctured. She had a ruptured spleen. The injuries were hard to interpret. The pathologist had offered the suggestion that a wooden club wrapped in cloth had been the weapon used. Why a killer would wrap a murder weapon in cloth could not be explained, but the scale of the injuries was not characteristic of an ordinary assault. The murder remained unsolved, and Gulbrandsson had said that the prospect of their solving the case was slender. The name Zala had come up on 4 occasions in the material that Mia had gathered over the last 2 years, but always on the periphery, always eerily elusive. Nobody knew who he was, and nobody could provide proof that he even existed. Some of the girls had referred to his name being used as a threat, a terrifying warning to those who did not toe the line. He had spent a whole week hunting for more concrete information about Zala, asking questions of police, journalists, and several recently developed sources with contacts in the sex trade. He had been in touch with the journalist Sandström, whom he had every intention of exposing in the book. Sandström had begged and pleaded for Svensson to have mercy. He had offered a bribe. Svensson was not going to change his mind, but he did use his advantage to pressure Sandström for information about Zala. Sandström claimed he had never met Zala, but he had talked to him on the telephone. No, he did not have the number. No, he could not say who had set up the contact. Svensson had been struck by the realization that Sandström was terrified. It was a terror beyond the threat of exposure. He was afraid for his life. Why? Chapter 10. Monday, March 14th to Sunday, March 20th. The journeys to and from Erster were time-consuming and a hassle. In the middle of March, Salander decided to buy a car. She started by acquiring a parking place. a much greater problem than buying the car itself. She had a space in the garage beneath the building in Mörsebacke, but she did not want anyone to be able to connect the car to where she lived on Fiskargarten. On the other hand, several years before she had put herself on a waiting list for a space in the garage of her old housing association apartment on Lundegarten. She called to find out where on the list she was now, and was told that she was at the top. And not only that, at the end of the month there would be a spot free. Sweet. She called Mimi and asked her to make a contract with the association right away. The next day she started hunting for a car. She had the money to buy whatever Rolls-Royce or Ferrari she wanted, but she was not remotely interested in anything ostentatious. Instead, she went to two dealers in Nacka and came away with a 4-year-old burgundy Honda automatic. She spent an hour going over every detail, including the engine, to the salesman's exasperation. On principle, she talked the price down a couple of thousand, and paid in cash. Then she drove to Lundegarten, where she knocked on Mimi's door and gave her a set of keys. Sure, Mimi could use the car if she asked in advance. Since the garage space would not be free until the end of the month, they parked on the street. Mimi was on her way to a date and a movie with a girlfriend Salander had never heard of. Since she was made up outrageously and dressed in something awful with what looked like a dog's collar round her neck, Salander assumed it was one of Mimi's flames, and when Mimi asked if she wanted to come along, she said no thanks. She had no desire to end up in a threesome with one of Mimi's long-legged girlfriends, who was no doubt unfathomably sexy, but would make her feel like an idiot. Anyway, Salander had something to do in town, so they took the Tunnelbana together to her Torget, and there they parted. Salander walked to on-off on Sveavägen, and made it with 2 minutes to spare before closing time. She bought a toner cartridge for her laser printer, and asked them to take it out of the box so that it would fit in her backpack. When she came out of the shop, she was thirsty and hungry. She walked to Stureplan, where she decided on Café Hedon, a place she had never been to before or even heard about. She instantly recognized Nils Bjurman from behind and turned right around in the doorway. She stood by the picture window facing the pavement and craned her neck so that she could observe her guardian from behind a serving counter. The sight of Bjurman aroused no dramatic feelings in Salander. Not anger, nor hatred, nor fear. As far as she was concerned, the world would assuredly be a better place without him, but he was alive only because she had decided that he would be more useful to her that way. She looked across at the man opposite Bjurman, and her eyes widened when he stood up. Click. He was an exceptionally big man, at least 6'6", and well-built. Exceptionally well-built, as a matter of fact. He had a weak face and short blonde hair, but overall he made a very powerful impression. Salander saw the man lean forward and say something quietly to Bjurman, who nodded. They shook hands, and Salander noticed that Bjurman quickly drew his hand back. "What sort of guy are you, and what business do you have with Bjurman?" Salander walked briskly down the street and stood under the awning of a tobacconist's shop. She was looking at a newspaper headline when the blonde man came out of Café Hedon, and without looking around turned left. He passed less than a foot behind Salander. She gave him a good head start before she followed him. It was not a long walk. The man went straight down into the Tunnelbana station at Birger Jarlsgarten and bought a ticket at the gate. He waited on the southbound platform, the direction Salander was going anyway, and got on a Norsborg train. He got off at Slusen, changed to the Green Line, towards Farsta, and got off again at Schanstuhl. From there he walked to Blumberg's Café on Goethegarten. Salander stopped outside. She studied the man the blonde hulk had come to meet. Click. Salander saw immediately that something sinister was going on. The man was overweight and had a narrow, untrustworthy face. His hair was pulled back into a ponytail, and he had a mousy moustache. He wore a denim jacket, black jeans, and high-heeled boots. On the back of his right hand he had a tattoo, but Salander could not make out the design. He wore a gold chain around his wrist and was smoking Lucky Strikes. His gaze was glassy-eyed, like someone who got high too often. Salander also noticed that he had a leather vest on under his jacket. She could tell he was a biker. The giant did not order anything. He seemed to be giving instructions. The man in the denim jacket paid close attention, but did not contribute to the conversation. Salander reminded herself that one day soon she should buy herself a shotgun mic. After only 5 minutes, the giant left Blumberg's Café. Salander retreated a few paces, but he did not even look in her direction. He walked 40 yards to the steps to Allhelgonagarten, where he got into a white Volvo. Salander managed to read his license plate number before he turned at the next corner. Salander hurried back to Blumberg's, but the table was empty. She looked up and down the street, but could not see the man with the ponytail. Then she caught a glimpse of him across the street as he pushed open the door to McDonald's. She had to go inside to find him again. He was sitting with another man, who was wearing his vest outside his denim jacket. Salander read the words, "Svarvesjö, M.C." The logo was a stylized motorcycle wheel that looked like a Celtic cross with an axe. She stood on Goethegarten for a minute before heading north. Her internal warning system had suddenly gone on high alert. Salander stopped at the 7-Eleven and bought a week's worth of food. A jumbo pack of Billy's Pan Pizza, 3 frozen fish casseroles, 3 bacon pies, 2 pounds of apples, 2 loaves of bread, 1 pound of cheese, milk, coffee, 1 carton of Marlboro Lights, and the evening papers. She walked up Svartensgarten to Mosebacke and looked all around before she punched in the door code of her building. She put 1 of the bacon pies in the microwave and drank milk straight from the carton. She switched on the coffee machine and then booted up her computer, clicking on Asphyxia 1.3 and logging into the mirrored copy of Bureman's hard drive. She spent the next half hour going through the contents of his computer. She found absolutely nothing of interest. He seemed to use his email rarely. She discovered only 12 brief personal messages to or from acquaintances. None of the emails had any connection to her. She found a newly created folder with porn photos that made clear that he was still interested in the sadistic humiliation of women. Technically, it wasn't a violation of her rule that he couldn't have anything to do with women. She opened the folder of documents, dealing with Bureman's role as Salander's guardian, and read through each of his monthly reports. They corresponded precisely to the copies he had sent to one of her Hotmail addresses. Everything normal. Maybe a small discrepancy. When she opened the file properties in Word for the various monthly reports, she could see that he usually wrote them in the first few days of each month, and that he spent about 4 hours editing each report and sent them punctually to the guardianship agency on the 20th of every month. It was now the middle of March, and he had not yet begun work on the current month's report. Lazy? Out too late? Busy with something else? Up to some tricks? Salander frowned. She shut down the computer and sat on her window seat and opened her cigarette case. She lit a cigarette and looked out at the darkness. She had been sloppy about keeping track of him. He's as slippery as an eel. She was genuinely worried. First Kalle fucking Blomqvist, then the name Zala, and now Niels fucking slimebag Bureman, together with an alpha male on steroids, with contacts in some gang of ex-con bikers. Within a few days, several ripples of disquiet had materialized in the orderly life Salander was trying to create for herself. At 2:30 the following morning, Salander put a key in the front door of the building on Upplandsgarten near Odenplan, where Bureman lived. She stopped outside his door, carefully lifted up the mail slot cover, and shoved in an extremely sensitive microphone she had bought at Counterspy in Mayfair in London. She had never heard of Ebbe Carlson, but that was the shop where he had bought the famous eavesdropping equipment that caused Sweden's Minister of Justice to resign suddenly in the late 1980s. Salander inserted her earpiece and adjusted the volume. She could hear the dull humming of the refrigerator and the sharp ticking of at least 2 clocks, one of which was the wall clock in the living room to the left of the front door. She turned up the volume and listened, holding her breath. She heard all sorts of creaks and rumbles from the apartment, but no evidence of human activity. It took her a minute to notice and decipher the faint sounds of heavy, regular breathing. Bureman was asleep. She withdrew the microphone and stuffed it in the pocket of her leather jacket. She was wearing dark jeans and sneakers with crepe soles. She inserted the key in the lock without a sound and pushed the door open a crack. Before she opened it all the way, she took the taser out of her pocket. She had brought no other weapon. She did not think she would need anything more powerful for dealing with Bureman. She closed the door behind her and padded on soundless feet towards the corridor outside his bedroom. She stopped when she saw the light from a lamp, but from where she stood she could already hear his snoring. She slipped into his bedroom. The lamp stood in the window.
"What's wrong, Björman? A little scared of the dark?"
She stood next to his bed and watched him for several minutes. He had aged and seemed unkempt. The room smelled of a man who was not taking good care of his hygiene. She did not feel a grain of sympathy. For a second, a hint of merciless hatred flashed in her eyes. She noticed a glass on the nightstand and leaned over to sniff it. Whiskey. After a while, she left the bedroom. She took a short tour through the kitchen, found nothing unusual, continued through the living room, and stopped at the door of Bjurman's office. From her jacket pocket, she took a handful of small bits of crisp bread, which she placed carefully on the parquet floor in the dark. If anyone tried to follow her through the living room, the crunching noise would alert her. She sat down at Bjurman's desk and placed the taser in front of her. Methodically, she searched the drawers and went through correspondence dealing with Bjurman's private accounts. She noticed that he had become sloppier and more sporadic with balancing his accounts. The bottom drawer of the desk was locked. Salander frowned. When she had visited a year before, all the drawers had been unlocked. Her eyes remained unfocused as she visualized the drawer's contents. It had contained a camera, a telephoto lens, a small Olympus pocket tape recorder, a leather-bound photograph album, and a little box with a necklace and a gold ring inscribed Tilda and Jakob Björman, April 23, 1951. Salander knew that these were the names of his parents and that both of them were dead. Presumably it was a wedding ring, now a keepsake. So, he locks up stuff he thinks is valuable. She inspected the roll-top cabinet behind the desk and took out the two binders containing his reports of her guardianship. For 15 minutes she read each one. Salander was a pleasant and conscientious young woman. 4 months earlier he had written that she seemed so rational and competent that there was good reason to discuss at the next annual review whether or not she required further guardianship. It was elegantly phrased and amounted to the first building block in the revocation of her declaration of incompetence. The binder also contained handwritten notes that showed Björman had been contacted by one Ulrika von Liebenstahl at the guardianship agency for a general discussion of Salander's condition. The words, "necessity for psychiatric assessment," had been underlined. Salander pouted, replaced the binders, and looked around. She could not find anything of note. Björman seemed to be behaving in accordance with her instructions. She bit her lower lip. She still had a feeling that something was not right. She got up from the chair and was about to turn off the desk lamp when she stopped. She took out the binders and looked through them again. She was perplexed. The binders should have contained more. A year ago there had been a summary of her development since childhood from the guardianship agency. That was missing. Why would Björman remove papers from an active case? She frowned. She could not think of any good reason, unless he was filing additional documentation somewhere else. Her eyes swept across the shelves of the roll-top cabinet and the bottom desk drawer. She did not have a picklock with her, so she padded back to Bjorman's bedroom and fished his keyring out of his suit jacket, which was hanging over a wooden valet stand. The same objects were in the drawer as a year ago, but the collection had been supplemented with a flat box whose printed illustration showed a Colt 45 Magnum. She thought through the research that she had done about Björman 2 years ago. He liked to shoot and was a member of a shooting club. According to the public weapons registry, he had a license for a Colt 45 Magnum. Reluctantly, she came to the conclusion that it was no surprise he kept the drawer locked. She did not like the situation, but she could not think of any immediate pretext for waking him and scaring the shit out of him. Johansson woke at 6:30 a.m. She heard the morning TV on low volume from the living room and smelled freshly brewed coffee. She also heard the clacking of keys from Svensson's iBook. She smiled. She had never seen him work so hard on a story before. Millennium had been a good move. He was often afflicted with writer's block, and it seemed as though hanging out with Blomqvist and Berger and the others was having a beneficial effect on him. He would come home gloomy after Blomqvist had pointed out shortcomings or shot down some of his reasoning, but then he'd work twice as hard. She wondered whether it was the right moment to interrupt his concentration. Her period was 3 weeks late. She had not yet taken the pregnancy test, Perhaps it was time. She would soon turn 30. In less than a month she had to defend her dissertation. Dr. Johansson. She smiled again and decided not to say anything to Svensson before she was sure. Maybe she would wait until he was finished with his book, and she was giving a party after she got her doctorate. She dozed for 10 more minutes before she got up and went into the living room with a sheet wrapped around her. He looked up.
"It's not 7 yet, she said.
"Blomqvist is acting superior again."
"Has he been mean to you?" "Serves you right." "You like him, don't you?"
Svensson leaned back in the living room sofa and met her eyes. After a moment he nodded.
"Millennium is a great place to work."
"I talked to Mikael at Kvarnen before you picked me up last night. He was wondering what I was going to be doing after this project was finished."
"Aha.
And what did you say?"
"That I didn't know. I've hung around as a freelancer for so many years now. I'd be glad of something more steady."
"Millennium."
He nodded.
"Mikael has tested the waters and wanted to know if I'd be interested in a part-time job. Same contract as Henry Cortez and Lotte Karim are on. I'd get a desk and a retainer from Millennium and could take in the rest on the side."
"Do you want to do that?"
"If they come up with a concrete offer, I'll say yes."
"Okay. But it's not 7 yet, and it's Saturday."
"I know. I just thought I'd polish it up a bit here and there."
"I think you should come back to bed and polish something else."
She smiled at him and turned up a corner of the sheet. He put the computer on standby. Salander spent a good deal of time over the next few days doing research on her power book. Her search extended in many different directions, and she was not always sure what she was looking for. Some of the fact-collecting was simple. From the media archive she put together a history of Svavelsjö MC. The club appeared in newspaper stories going by the name Telja Hog Riders. Police had raided the clubhouse, at that time located in an abandoned schoolhouse outside Södertälje, when neighbours reported shots fired. The police turned up in astonishing force and broke up a beer-drenched party that had degenerated into a shooting contest with an AK-4, which later turned out to have been stolen from the disbanded I-20 regiment in Västerbotten in the early 1980s. According to one evening paper, Svavelsjö MC had 6 or 7 members and a dozen hangers-on. All the full members had been in jail. 2 stood out. The club leader was Carl Magnus Magger Lundin, who was pictured in Aftonbladet when the police raided the premises in 2001. He had been convicted on 5 charges of theft, receiving stolen goods, and for drug offences in the late 1980s and early 1990s. One of the sentences, for a crime which involved grievous bodily harm, put him away for 18 months. He was released in 1995 and soon afterwards became president of Telja Hog Riders, now Svavelsjö MC. According to the police gang unit, the club's number 2 was Sonny Niemanen, now 37 years old, who had run up no fewer than 23 convictions. He had started his career at the age of 16, when he was put on probation and in institutional care for assault and battery and theft. Over the next 10 years he was convicted on 5 counts of theft, 1 of aggravated theft, 2 of unlawful intimidation, 2 narcotics offences, extortion, assault on a civil servant, 2 counts of possessing an illegal weapon, 1 criminal weapons charge, driving under the influence, and 6 counts of assault. He had been sentenced according to a scale that was incomprehensible to Salander: probation, fines, and repeated stints of 30 to 60 days in jail, until 1989 when he was put away for 10 months for aggravated assault and robbery. He was out a few months later and kept his nose clean until October 1990. Then he got into a fight in a bar in Södertälje and ended up with a conviction for manslaughter and a 6-year prison sentence. He was out by 1995. In 1996 he was arrested as an accessory to an armed robbery. He had provided 3 of the robbers with weapons. He was sentenced to 4 years and released in 1999. According to a newspaper article from 2001 in which Niemanen was not named, but where the details of the suspect were such that he was effectively identified, he looked more than likely to have played his part in the murder of a member of a rival gang. Salander downloaded the mugshots of Niemanen and Lundin. Niemanen had a photogenic face with dark, curly hair and dangerous eyes. Lundin just looked like a complete idiot, and was without doubt the man who had met the giant at Blomberg's Café. Niemanen was the man waiting in McDonald's. Via the National Vehicle Register, she traced the white Volvo to the car rental firm Auto Expert in Eskilstuna. She dialed their number and spoke to a Refik Alba.
"My name is Gunilla Hansson. My dog was run over yesterday by someone who just drove off. The bastard was driving a car from your firm. I could tell from the license plate. A white Volvo."
She gave the number. "I'm so sorry."
"That's not enough, I'm afraid. I want the name of the driver so that I can sue him."
"Have you reported the matter to the police?"
"No, I'd like to settle it directly."
"I'm sorry, but I can't give out the names of our clients unless a police report has been filed." Salander's voice darkened. She asked whether it was good practice to oblige her to report the company's clients to the police force instead of resolving matters with much less trouble. Refik Alba apologized once more and repeated that he was powerless to circumvent company rules. The name Zala was another dead end. With two breaks for Billy's Pan Pizza, Salander spent most of the day at her computer with only a big bottle of Coca-Cola for company. She found hundreds of Zalas, from an Italian athlete to a composer in Argentina. But she did not find the one she was looking for. She tried Zalachenko, but that was a dead end, too. Frustrated, she stumbled into bed and slept for 12 hours straight. When she woke, it was 11 a.m. She put on some coffee and ran a bath in the jacuzzi. She poured in bubble bath and brought coffee and sandwiches for breakfast. She wished that she had Mimi to keep her company, but she still had not even told her where she lived. At noon she got out of the bath, toweled herself dry, and put on a bathrobe. She turned on the computer again. The names Doug Svensson and Mia Johansson yielded better results. Via Google's search engine, she was able to quickly put together a brief summary of what they had been up to in recent years. She downloaded copies of some of Svensson's articles and found a photographic byline of him. No great surprise that he was the man she had seen with Blomqvist at Kvarnen. The name had been given a face, and vice versa. She found several texts about or by Mia Johansson. She had first come to the media's attention with a report on the different treatment received by men and women at the hands of the law. There had been a number of editorials and articles in women's organizations' newsletters. Johansson herself had written several more articles. Salander read attentively. Some feminists found Johansson's conclusions significant. Others criticized her for spreading bourgeois illusions. At 2 in the afternoon she went into Asphyxia 1.3, but instead of Mick Blom/laptop, she selected Mick Blom/office, Blomqvist's desktop computer at Millennium. She knew from experience that his office computer contained hardly anything of interest. Apart from the fact that he sometimes used it to surf the net, he worked almost exclusively on his iBook. But he did have administrator rights for the whole Millennium office. She quickly found what she was looking for. The password for Millennium's internal network. To get into other computers at Millennium, the mirrored hard drive on the server in Holland was not sufficient. The original of Mick Blom/office also had to be on and connected to the internal computer network. She was in luck. Blomqvist was apparently at work and had his desktop on. She waited 10 minutes but could not see any sign of activity, which she took to indicate that he had turned on the computer when he came into the office and had possibly used it to surf the net, then left it on while he did something else, or used his laptop. This had to be done carefully. During the next hour, Salander hacked cautiously from one computer to another and downloaded email from Berger, Malm, and an employee whose name she did not recognize, Malin Eriksson. Finally, she located Svensson's desktop. According to the system information, it was an older Macintosh Power PC with a hard disk of only 750 megabytes, so it must be a leftover that was probably only used for word processing by occasional freelancers. It was linked to the computer network, which meant that Svensson was in Millennium's editorial offices right now. She downloaded his email and searched his hard drive. She found a folder with a short but sweet name, Zala. The blonde giant had just picked up 203,000 kroner in cash, which was an unexpectedly large sum for the 3 kilos of methamphetamine he had delivered to Lundin in late January. It was a tidy profit for a few hours of practical work, collecting the meth from the courier, storing it for a while, making delivery to Lundin, and then taking 50% of the profit. Savasur MC could turn over that amount every month, and Lundin's gang was only one of three such operations. The other two were around Göteborg and Malmö. Together the gangs brought him roughly 500,000 kroner in profit every month. And yet he was in such a bad mood that he pulled over to the side of the road and turned off the engine. He had not slept for 30 hours and was feeling fuzzy. He got out to stretch his legs and take a piss. The night was cool and the stars were bright. He was not far from Järna. The conflict he was having was almost ideological in nature. The potential supply of methamphetamine was limitless within a radius of 250 miles from Stockholm. The demand was indisputably huge. The rest was logistics, how to transport the product from point A to point B, or to be more precise, from a cellar workshop in Tallinn to the free port in Stockholm. This was a recurring problem. How to guarantee regular transport from Estonia to Sweden? In fact, it was the main problem and the weak link, since after several years he was still improvising every time. And fuck-ups have been all too frequent lately. He was proud of his ability to organize. He had built up a well-oiled network cultivated with equal portions of carrot and stick. He was the one who had done the legwork, cemented partnerships, negotiated deals, and made sure that the deliveries got to the right place. The carrot was the incentive offered to subcontractors like Lundin, a solid and relatively risk-free profit. The system was a good one. Lundin did not have to lift a finger to get the goods. No stressful buying trips or dealings with people who could be anyone from the drug squad to the Russian mafia. Lundin knew that the giant would deliver and then collect his 50%. The stick was for when complications arose. A gabby street dealer who had found out far too much about the supply chain had almost implicated Svavelsjö MC. He had been forced to get involved and punish the guy. He was good at dealing out punishment. But the operation was becoming too burdensome to oversee. He lit a cigarette and stretched his legs against a gate into a field. Methamphetamine was a discreet and easy-to-manage source of income. Big profits, small risks. Weapons were risky, and considering the risks, they were simply not good business. Occasionally, industrial espionage or smuggling electronic components to Eastern Europe, even though the market had dropped off in recent years, was justifiable. Whores from the Baltics, on the other hand, were an entirely unsatisfactory investment. The business was small change and liable at any time to set off hypocritical screeds in the media and debates in that strange political entity called the Swedish Parliament. The one advantage was that everybody likes a whore. Prosecutors, judges, policemen, even an occasional member of Parliament. Nobody was going to dig too deep to bring that business down. Even a dead whore would not necessarily cause a political uproar. If the police could catch a suspect within a few hours who still had bloodstains on his clothes, then a conviction would follow and the murderer would spend several years in prison or some other obscure institution. But if no suspect was found within 48 hours, the police would soon enough find more important things to investigate, as he knew from experience. He did not like to trade in whores, though. He did not like them at all. Their make-up, plastered faces, and shrill, drunken laughter. They were unclean, and there was always the risk that one of them would get the idea she could seek asylum, or start blabbing to the police or to reporters. Then he would have to take matters into his own hands and mete out punishment. And if the revelation was blatant enough, prosecutors and police would be forced to act. Otherwise, Parliament really would wake up and pay attention. The whore business sucked. The brothers Atto and Harry Ranta were typical. Two useless parasites who had found out way too much about the business. Most of all, he would like to tie them up with chains and dump them in the harbour. Instead, he had driven them to the Estonia ferry and patiently waited until it sailed. Their little vacation was the result of some fucking reporter sticking his nose into their business, and it was decided that they had better make themselves scarce. He sighed. Above all, he did not appreciate diversions like that Salander girl. She was utterly without interest as far as he was concerned. She represented no profit whatsoever. He did not like Björman, and he could not imagine why they had decided to do what he wanted. But now the ball was rolling. Instructions had been issued. The contract had been awarded to a freelancer from Svavelsjö MC, and he did not like the situation one bit. He looked out across the dark field, tossing his cigarette butt into the gravel by the gate. He thought he saw movement out of the corner of his eye and froze. He focused his gaze. There was no light, except from a faint crescent moon and the stars, but he could still make out the contours of a black figure creeping towards him about 100 feet away. The figure advanced, making short pauses. The man felt a cold sweat on his brow. He hated the creature in the field. For a minute he stared spellbound at its steady approach. When it was close enough that he could see its eyes glimmer in the darkness, he spun around and ran to the car. He tore open the door. He felt his panic growing until he got the engine started and turned on the headlights. The creature had come out to the road, and at last he could make out features in the beam. It looked like an enormous stingray slithering along. It had a stinger like a scorpion. The creature was not of this world. It was a monster from the underworld. He put the car in gear and screeched off. As he passed the creature, he saw it strike, but it did not touch the car. He did not stop shaking until several miles later. Salander spent the night going over the research that Svensson and Millennium had compiled about trafficking. Gradually she was getting a good overview, even though it was based on cryptic fragments that she had to piece together from their various documents. Berger sent an email to Blomqvist asking how the confrontations were going. He replied briefly that they could not run the man from the Cheka to Earth. Salander took this to mean that one of the people who was going to be hung out to dry worked at SIPO, the security police. Eriksson sent a summary of a supplementary research assignment to Svensson with copies to Blomqvist and Berger. Svensson and Blomqvist replied with comments and suggestions. Blomqvist and Svensson exchanged emails a few times each day. Svensson described a confrontation he had had with a journalist, Per-Åke Sandström. From Svensson's emails, she also saw that he was communicating with a person by the name of Gulbrandsson at a Yahoo address. It took her a while to realize that Gulbrandsson was a policeman and that their exchange was off the record, using a private email address instead of Gulbrandsson's police address. So Gulbrandsson was a source. The folder named Zala was disappointingly brief, only 3 Word documents. The longest of them, just 128 kilobytes, was called Irina P., and gave a sketch of a prostitute's life, followed by Svensson's summary of the autopsy report, his curt outline of her appalling wounds. She recognized a phrase in the text that was a word-for-word quotation from Johansson's dissertation. There the woman had been called Tamara. But Irina P. and Tamara had to be one and the same, so she read the interview section of the thesis with great interest. The second document, Sandström, contained the summary that Svensson had emailed to Blomqvist, showing that the journalist was one of several Johns who had abused a girl from the Baltics, and also that he ran errands for the sex mafia in exchange for drugs and sex. Sandström, besides producing company newsletters, had written freelance articles for a daily newspaper indignantly condemning the sex trade. One of his revelations was that an unnamed Swedish businessman had visited a brothel in Tallinn. Zala was not mentioned in either document, but Salander assumed that since both were in a folder named Zala, there must be a connection. The last document was, however, named Zala. It was short and only in note form. According to Svensson, the name Zala had turned up in 9 cases related to drugs, weapons, or prostitution since the mid-90s. Nobody knew who Zala was, but sources had variously indicated that he was a Serb, a Pole, or perhaps a Czech. All the information was second-hand. Svensson had discussed Zala exhaustively with Source G, Gulbrandsson, and suggested that Zala may have been responsible for the murder of Irina P. There was no saying what G thought about this theory, but there was a note to the effect that Zala had been on the agenda a year earlier at a meeting with the Special Investigative Group on Organized Crime. The name had cropped up so many times that the police had started asking questions, trying to establish whether Zala was a real person, and whether he was still alive. As far as Svensson could discover, the name Zala had first appeared in connection with a hold-up of a security van in Orkidsjunga in 1996. The robbers had gotten away with more than 3.3 million kronor, but they had so dramatically botched their getaway that after only 24 hours the police were able to identify and arrest the gang members. The following day another arrest was made. It was Niemannen, a member of Savelshire MC whose role had been to supply the weapons used in the hold-up. A week after the robbery in 1996, three more people were arrested. The ring thus included 8 people, of whom 7 had refused to talk to the police. The 8th, a boy of 19 named Birger Nordmann, had broken down and confessed everything he knew during questioning. The trial turned into a runaway victory for the prosecution. One consequence was, Svensson's police source suspected, that Nordmann was found 2 years later buried in a sandpit in Värmland after running away during temporary leave from prison. According to G, the police believed that Niemannen had been the catalyst behind the whole gang. They also believed that Nordmann had been killed on contract by Niemannen, who was regarded as dangerous and ruthless, but there was no evidence. While in prison, he had apparently had dealings with the Aryan Brotherhood, a Nazi prison organization that in turn was linked to the Wolfpack Brotherhood and to ex-con Hell's Angels clubs around the world, as well as to other cretinous, violent Nazi organizations such as the Swedish Resistance Movement. What interested Salander, however, was something else entirely. Nordmann had admitted to police that the weapons used in the robbery had come from Niemannen, and that he in turn had got them from a Serb not known to Nordmann, whom he named as Sala. Svensson had taken him for an anonymous figure in the criminal scene, and reckoned that Sala was a nickname. But he warned that they might be dealing with a particularly cunning criminal who operated under an alias. The last section contained Sandström's information on Sala, such as it was. Sandström had once talked on the telephone to someone using that name. The notes did not say what the conversation had been about. At around 4 in the morning, Salander shut down her power book and sat on her window seat looking out at Saltsjön. She sat quietly for 2 hours, smoking one cigarette after another, thinking. She had a number of strategic decisions to make, and she had to do a risk assessment. She had to find Sala and settle their accounts once and for all. On Saturday evening, the week before Easter, Blomqvist visited an old girlfriend on Sleepgarten in the Hornstull neighbourhood. He had for once accepted an invitation to a party. She was married now and not remotely interested in Blomqvist as anything more than a friend, but she worked in the media and had just finished a book that had been in gestation for 10 years, which dealt with the image of women in the mass media. Blomqvist had contributed to the book, which was why he was invited. His role had been to do research on one question. He had chosen to examine the equal opportunity policies which the TT wire service, Dagens Nyheter, the TV show Rapport, and a number of other media ostentatiously promoted. Then he checked off how many men and women were in each company's management above the level of editorial assistant. The results were embarrassing. CEO, man. Chairman of the board, man. Editor-in-chief, man. Foreign editor, man. Managing editor, man, etc. Until eventually the first woman turned up. The party was at the author's house, and the people there were mostly those who had helped her with the book. It was a high-spirited evening with good food and relaxed conversation. Blomqvist had meant to go home reasonably early, but many of the guests were old acquaintances he seldom saw. Besides, no one jabbered on too much about the Wennerström affair. The party went on until around 2 on Sunday morning. Blomqvist saw the night bus drive past before he could make it to the bus stop, but the air was mild and he decided to walk home instead of waiting for the next one. He followed Hörgelitsgarten to the church and turned up Lundegarten, which instantly awakened old memories. Blomqvist had kept the promise he'd made in December, to stop visiting Lundegarten in the vain hope that Salander might appear. Tonight he stopped, on the other side of the street from her building. He longed to ring the doorbell, but he knew how unlikely it was that she would want to see him, let alone at this time of night, with no warning. He shrugged and kept walking towards Zinkensdamm. He had gone about 60 yards when he heard a door open and turned, and then his heart skipped a beat. It was impossible to mistake that skinny body. Salander had just walked out to the street and away from him. She stopped the parked car. Blomqvist opened his mouth to call to her when his voice caught in his throat. He saw a man get out of another of the cars parked along the curb. He moved rapidly up behind Salander. Blomqvist could see that he was tall and had a ponytail. Salander heard a sound and saw a movement out of the corner of her eye just as she was putting the key in the door of the Honda. He was approaching at an angle behind her, and she spun around 2 seconds before he reached her. She identified him instantly as Carl Magnus Lundin of Svavelsjö MC, who several days ago had met the blonde hulk at Bloomberg's Café. She gauged him as aggressive and weighing over 265 pounds. She used her keys as brass knuckles and didn't hesitate a millisecond before, with a movement as swift as a lizard, she slashed a deep wound in his cheek from the bottom of his nose to his ear. He was flailing at the air as Salander then seemed to sink through the ground. Blomqvist saw Salander lash out with her fist. At the instant she struck her attacker, she dropped to the ground and rolled beneath the car. Seconds later, Salander was up on the other side of the car, ready for fight or flight. She met the enemy's gaze across the hood and decided on the latter option. Blood was pouring from his cheek. Before he even managed to focus on her, she was away across Lundegarten, running towards Högelid Church. Blomqvist stood paralyzed, his mouth agape, when the attacker suddenly dashed after Salander. He looked like a tank chasing a toy car. Salander took the steps to Upper Lundegarten two at a time. At the top of the stairs, she glanced over her shoulder and saw her pursuer reaching the first step. He was fast. She noticed the piles of boards and sand where the local authority had dug up the street. Lundin was almost up the steps when Salander came into view again. He had time to register that she was throwing something, but he did not have time to react before the sharp-edged cobblestone hit him on the temple. The stone was thrown with considerable force, and it ripped another wound on his face. He could feel himself losing his footing, and then the world spun as he fell backwards down the steps. He managed to break his fall by grabbing the railing, but he had lost several seconds. Blomqvist's paralysis dissolved when the man disappeared up the stairs. He started yelling for him to fuck off. Salander was halfway across the churchyard when she heard Blomqvist's voice. What the hell? She switched directions and looked over the railing of the terrace. She saw Blomqvist 10 feet below her. She hesitated a tenth of a second before she took off again. At the same time as Blomqvist began to run towards the steps, he noticed that a Dodge van was starting up outside Salander's front door, behind the car she had tried to get into. The vehicle swung out from the curb and passed Blomqvist, going in the direction of Zinkensdamm. He caught a glimpse of a face as it passed. It was too dark to read the license plate. Blomqvist caught up with Salander's pursuer at the top of the steps. The man had stopped and stood motionless, looking around. Just as Blomqvist got to him, he turned and gave him a powerful backhand across the face. Blomqvist was completely unprepared. He tumbled headlong down the steps. Salander heard Blomqvist's stifled cry and almost stopped. What the hell is going on? But when she turned, she saw Lundin only 100 feet from her. He's faster. Shit, he's going to catch me. She turned left and ran up several steps to the terrace between two buildings. She reached a courtyard that did not present the least cover, and ran as fast as she could to the next corner. She turned right and realized just in time that she would be heading into a blind alley. As she reached the end of the next building, she saw Lundin arrive at the top of the steps to the courtyard. She kept running, out of his sight, for another few yards, and dived headfirst into a rhododendron bush alongside the building. She heard Lundin's heavy footsteps, but she could not see him. She held her breath, pressing herself into the soil beneath the bush. Lundin passed her hiding place and stopped. He hesitated for 10 seconds before jogging around the courtyard. A minute later he came back. He stopped at the same place as before. This time he stood still for 30 seconds. Salander tensed her muscles, poised for instant flight if she were discovered. Then he moved again, passing less than 6 feet from her. She listened to his steps fade away across the courtyard. Blomqvist felt pain in his neck and jaw as he got laboriously to his feet, feeling dizzy. He tasted blood from a split lip. He made his way unsteadily to the top of the steps and looked around. He saw the man with the ponytail running 100 yards further down the street. The man stopped and peered between the buildings and then ran across Lundegarten and climbed into the Dodge van. The vehicle sped off towards Zinkensdamm. Blomqvist walked slowly along the upper part of Lundegarten, looking for Salander. He could not see her anywhere. There was not a living soul. He was astonished how desolate a street in Stockholm can be at 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning in March. After a while he went back to the front door of Salander's apartment building on Lower Lundegarten. As he passed the car where the attack had taken place, he stepped on a key ring. He bent to pick it up and saw a shoulder bag under the car. Blomqvist stood there a long time, waiting, unsure what to do. At last he tried the keys in her door. They did not fit. Salander stayed under the bush for 15 minutes, moving only to look at her watch. Just after 3, she heard a door open and close, and footsteps making for the bicycle shed in the courtyard. When the sound died away, she raised herself slowly to her knees and peered out of the bush. She looked steadily at every nook and cranny in the courtyard, but she saw no sign of Lundin. She walked back to the street, prepared to turn tail at any moment. She stopped at the top of the wall and looked out over Lundegarten, where she saw Blomqvist outside her apartment building. He was holding her bag in his hand. She stood perfectly still, hidden behind a lamppost, when Blomqvist's gaze swept over the stairs and the wall. He did not see her. Blomqvist stood outside her door for almost half an hour. She watched him patiently, without moving, until finally he gave up and headed down the hill towards Zinkensdamm. When he was gone, she began to think about what had happened. Kalle Blomqvist. She could not, for the life of her, imagine how he had sprung up out of nowhere. Apart from that, the attack was not difficult to account for. Carl fucking Magnus Lundin. Lundin had met the Hulk she had seen talking to Bjurman. Nils fucking slimebag Bjurman. That piece of shit has hired some diabolical alpha male to get me out of the way, and I made it crystal clear to him what the consequences would be. Salander was seething inside. She was so enraged that she tasted blood in her mouth. Now she was going to have to punish him.
Part 3. Absurd Equations. March 23rd to April 3rd. Those pointless equations, to which no solution exists, are called absurdities. A plus B times A minus B equals A squared minus B squared plus 1. Chapter 11. Wednesday, March 23rd to Monday, Thursday, March 24th. Blomqvist took his red pen and, in the margin of Svensson's manuscript, drew a question mark with a circle around it and wrote, footnote. He wanted a source reference inserted. It was Wednesday, the evening before Maundy Thursday, and Millennium was more or less closed down for Easter week. Nielsen was out of the country, Karim had gone to the mountains with her husband. Cortez had come in to deal with telephone messages for a few hours, but Blomqvist sent him home since nobody was calling. Cortez left, smiling happily, on his way to see a new girlfriend. Svensson had not been around. Blomqvist sat in the office alone, plodding through his manuscript. The book was going to be 12 chapters and 288 pages long. Svensson had delivered the final text of 9 of the 12 chapters, and Blomqvist had been over every word and given the hard copy back with requests for clarification and suggestions for reworking. Svensson was a talented writer, and Blomqvist confined his editing for the most part to marginal notes. During the weeks when the manuscript had been growing on his desk, they had disagreed about only one paragraph, which Blomqvist wanted to delete, and Svensson fought tooth and nail to keep. It stayed in. In short, Millennium had an excellent book that would very soon be off to the printer. There was no doubt that it would make dramatic headlines. Svensson was merciless in his exposure of the Johns, and he told the story in such a way that nobody could fail to understand that there was something wrong with the system itself. It was journalistic work of the type that should be on the endangered species list. Blomqvist had learned that Svensson was an exacting journalist who left very few loose ends. He did not employ the heavy-handed rhetoric typical of so much other social reporting, which turned texts into pretentious trash. His book was more than an exposé. It was a declaration of war. Blomqvist smiled to himself. Svensson was about 15 years younger, but he recognized the passion that he himself had once had when he took up the lance against second-rate financial reporters and put together a scandalous book. Certain newsrooms had not forgiven him. The problem with Svensson's book was that it had to be watertight. A reporter who sticks out his neck like that has to either stand behind his story 100% or refrain from publishing it.
Right now, Svensson was at 98%. There were still a few weak points that needed more work and one or two assertions that he had not adequately documented. At 5:30 p.m., Blomqvist opened his desk drawer and took out a cigarette. Berger had decreed a total ban in the office, but he was alone and nobody else was going to be there that weekend. He worked for another 40 minutes before he gathered up the pages and put the chapter on Berger's desk. Svensson had promised to email the final text of the remaining three chapters the following morning, which would give Blomqvist a chance to go through them over the weekend. A summit meeting was planned for the Tuesday after Easter, when they would all sign off on the final version of the book and the Millennium articles. After that, only the layout remained, which was Malm's headache alone, and then it would go to the printer. Blomqvist had not sought bids from different printers. He would entrust the job to Hallvigs Reklam in Morgengåva. They had printed his book about the Wennerström affair and had given him a damn good price and first-rate service. Blomqvist looked at the clock and decided to reward himself with another cigarette. He sat at the window and stared down on Gürtgarten. He ran his tongue over the cut on the inside of his lip. It was beginning to heal. He wondered for the 1,000th time what really had happened outside Salander's building early on Sunday morning. All he knew for certain was that Salander was alive and back in Stockholm. He had tried to reach her every day since then. He had sent emails to the address she had used more than a year ago. He had walked up and down Lundegarten. He was beginning to despair. The nameplate on the door now read, Salander Wu. There were about 230 people with the surname Wu on the electoral roll, of whom about 140 lived in and around Stockholm, none of them on Lundegarten. Blomqvist had no idea whether she had a boyfriend or had rented out the apartment. No one came to the door when he knocked. Finally, he went back to his desk and wrote her a good old-fashioned letter. Hello, Sally. I don't know what happened a year ago, but by now even a numbskull like me has worked out that you've cut off all contact. It's for you to decide who you hang around with, and I don't mean to nag. I just want to tell you that I still think of you as my friend, that I miss your company, and would love to have a cup of coffee with you, if you felt like it. I don't know what kind of a mess you've got yourself into, but the ruckus on Lundegarten was alarming. If you need help, you can call me any time. As you know, I am deeply in your debt. Plus, I have your shoulder bag. When you want it back, just let me know. If you don't want to see me, just give me an address to mail it to. I promise not to bother you, since you've indicated clearly enough that you don't want anything to do with me. Mikhail. As anticipated, he never heard a word from her. When he had got home the morning after the attack on Lundegarten, he opened the shoulder bag and spread the contents on the kitchen table. There was a wallet with an ID card, about 600 kroner, 200 American dollars, and a monthly travel card. There was a pack of Marlboro lights, 3 Bic lighters, a box of throat lozenges, a packet of tissues, a toothbrush, toothpaste, 3 tampons in a side pocket, an unopened pack of condoms with a price sticker that showed they were bought at Gatwick Airport in London, a bound notebook with stiff black A4 dividers, 5 ballpoint pens, a can of mace, a small bag with makeup, an FM radio with an earphone but no batteries, and Saturday's Aftonbladet. The most intriguing item was a hammer, easily accessible in an outside pocket. However, the attack had come so suddenly that she had not been able to make use of it or the mace. She had evidently used her keys as brass knuckles. There were still traces of blood and skin on them. Of the 6 keys on the ring, 3 of them were typical apartment keys, front door, apartment door, and the key to a padlock, but none of them fit the door of the building on Lundegarten. Blomqvist opened the notebook and went through it page by page. He recognized Salander's neat hand and could see at once that this was not a girl's secret diary. 3/4 of the pages were filled with what looked like mathematical notations. At the top of the first page was an equation that even Blomqvist recognized. X cubed plus Y cubed equals Z cubed. Blomqvist had never had trouble doing calculations. He had left secondary school with the highest marks in math, which in no way meant, of course, that he was a mathematician, only that he had been able to absorb the content of the school's curriculum. But Salander's pages contained formulas of a type that Blomqvist neither understood nor could even begin to understand. One equation stretched across an entire double page and ended with things crossed out and changed. He could not even tell whether they were real mathematical formulas and calculations, but since he knew Salander's peculiarities, he assumed that the equations were genuine and no doubt had some esoteric